A way to a place on Google where normal people don't look, a place like page 2 of the search results. According to Google's own research into our eye movements, 53% of us don't go beyond the first 2 search results, and 89% of us don't look down past the first page. What the first page looks like, Michael's strategist Jared Higgins told me during my tour of their offices, determines what people think of you. As a writer and a journalist, as well as a father and a human being, this struck me as a really horrifying way of knowing the world. I'm passionate about music, Lindsay told Farouk. I like top 40 chart music. That's really good, said Farouk. Let's work with that. Do you play an instrument? I used to, Lindsay said. I was kind of self-taught. It's just something I mess around with. It's not anything I... Suddenly she trailed off. At first, she'd sounded like she'd been enjoying the fun of it all. But now she seemed self-conscious, like the endeavour was giving her troubling existential thoughts. Questions like, who am I? And what are we doing? I'm having a hard time with this, she said. As a normal person, I don't really know how to brand myself online. I'm trying to come up with things for you guys to write about, but it's hard, you know? Piano, guitar, drums, said Farouk. Or travel. Where do you go? I don't know, Lindsay said. I go to the cave. I go to the beach. I get ice cream. At Farouk's request, Lindsay had been emailing him photographs that didn't involve her inadvertently flipping off military cemeteries. She'd been providing biographical details, too. Her favourite TV show was Parks and Recreation. Her employment history included 5 years at Walmart, which was kind of soul-suckingly awful. Are you sure you want to say that Walmart was soul-sucking? Farouk said. Oh, what, really? Lindsay laughed as if to say, come on, everyone knows that about Walmart. But then she hesitated. The conference call was proving an unexpectedly melancholic experience. It was nothing to do with Farouk. He really felt for Lindsay and wanted to do a good job for her. The sad thing was that Lindsay had incurred the internet's wrath because she was impudent and playful and foolhardy and outspoken. And now here she was, working with Farouk to reduce herself to safe banalities, to cats and ice cream and top 40 chart music. We were creating a world where the smartest way to survive is to be bland. There was a time when Michael Furtick wouldn't have needed to be so calculating. Back in the mid-1990s, search engines were only interested in how many times a particular keyword appeared within a page. To be the number one John Ronson search term on AltaVista or Hotbot, you just had to write John Ronson over and over again, which for me would be the most fantastic website to chance upon, but for everyone else, less so. But then 2 students at Stanford, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, had their idea. Why not build a search engine that ranked websites by popularity instead? If someone is linking to your page, that's one vote. A link, they figured, is like a citation, a nod of respect. If the page linking to your page has lots of links into it, then that page counts for more votes. An esteemed person bestowing their admiration upon you is worth more than some loner doing the same. And that was it. They called their invention PageRank after Larry Page, and as soon as they turned the algorithm on, us early searchers were spellbound. This was why Farouk needed to create LinkedIn and Tumblr and Twitter pages for Lindsay. They come with a built-in high page rank. The Google algorithm prejudges them as well-liked. But for Michael, the problem with Google is that it's forever evolving, adjusting its algorithm in ways it keeps secret. Google is a tricky beast and a moving target, Michael told me, and so we tried to decipher it, to reverse engineer it. This is what Michael knew right now. Google tends to like stuff that's old. It seems to think old stuff has a certain authority. And Google tends to like stuff that's new. With the intervening stuff, week 6, week 12, there's a dip. Which is why Michael's people predicted that Lindsay's love of cats or whatever would achieve initial strong impact, followed by fluctuation. And after fluctuation, reversion. Michael's clients dread reversion. There's nothing more dispiriting than seeing the nice new judgments disappear down to page 2 and the horrific old judgments bubble back up again. But reversion is actually their friend, Jared Higgins told me. Reversion is when you think Glenn Close is dead, but she suddenly leaps up in the bath, apparently filled with a new violent fervour, but really she's just muddled and wounded and vulnerable. Reversion shows the algorithm is uncertain, Jared said. It's the algorithm shifting things around and wondering what, from a mathematical standpoint, is the story that needs to be told about this person. And during this uncertainty, Jared said, we go in and blast it. The blasting, the bombardment of the algorithm with Tumblr pages about Lindsay's trips to the beach, the shock and awe of these pleasant banalities has to be choreographed just right. Google knows if it's being manipulated. Alarm bells go off. So we have a strategic schedule for content creation and publication, Jared said. We create a natural-looking activity online. That's a lot of accumulated intelligence. Michael Furtick took me for dinner and talked to me about the criticism people often level at him that any change of the search results is manipulating truth and chilling free speech. He drank some wine. But there is a chilling of behaviour that goes along with a virtual lynching. There is a life modification. I know, I said. For a year, Lindsay Stone had felt too plagued to even go to karaoke. And karaoke is something you do alone in a room with your friends. And that's not an unusual reaction, Michael said. People change their phone numbers. They don't leave the house. They go into therapy. They have signs of PTSD. It's like the Stasi. We're creating a culture where people feel constantly surveilled, where people are afraid to be themselves. Like the NSA, I said. This is more frightening than the NSA, Michael said. The NSA is looking for terrorists. They're not getting psychosexual pleasure out of their schadenfreude about you. I wondered what to make of Michael's Stasi analogy. There's an old internet adage that as soon as you compare something to the Nazis, you lose the argument. Maybe the same could be said about the Stasi, the East German secret police force during the Cold War. They would, after all, creep into the homes of suspected enemies of the state and spray radiation onto them as they slept, their idea being to use the radiation as a tracking device. Stasi agents would follow them through crowds, pointing Geiger counters at them. A lot of suspected enemies of the state died of unusual cancers during the Stasi's reign. But the Stasi weren't just about inflicting physical horror. Their main endeavour was to create the most elaborate surveillance network in world history. It didn't seem unreasonable to scrutinise this aspect of them in the hope it might teach us something about our own social media surveillance network. In Anna Funder's seminal history of the Stasi, Stasiland, she interviews a woman named Julia, who was one day called in for interrogation. The Stasi had intercepted love letters between her and her Western boyfriend. They were sitting on the officer's desk in the interrogation room. There was a pile of her letters to the Italian. There was a pile of his letters back to her. This man knew everything. He could see where she had doubts. He could see by what sweet-talking she had let herself be placated. He could see the Italian boyfriend's longing laid bare. Anna Funder, Stasiland, Granta, 2003. Julia told Anna Funder that she was definitely psychologically damaged by the incident. The way the officer read through her letters in front of her, making little comments. That's probably why I react so extremely to approaches from men. I experience them as another possible invasion of my intimate sphere. Anna Funder wrote Stasiland back in 2003, 14 years after the fall of the Stasi and 3 years before the invention of Twitter. Of course, no prurient or censorious bureaucrat had intercepted Justine Sacco's private thoughts. Justine had tweeted them herself, labouring under the misapprehension, the same one I laboured under for a while, that Twitter was a safe place to tell the truth about yourself to strangers. That truth-telling had really proven to be an idealistic experiment gone wrong. Anna Funder visited a Stasi officer whose job had been to co-opt informants. She wanted to know how, given that informant pay was so terrible and the workload was ever burgeoning, with more and more behaviours being redefined as enemy activities, he managed to persuade people to get on board. Mostly people just said yes, he told her. Why? She asked him. Some of them were convinced of the cause, he said, but I think mainly because informers felt they were somebody, you know? Someone was listening to them for a couple of hours every week, taking notes. They felt like they had it over other people. This struck me as a condescending thing for the Stasi man to say about his informants. And it would be a condescending thing to say about Twitter users, too. Social media gives a voice to voiceless people. Its egalitarianism is its greatest quality. But I was struck by a report Anna Funder discovered that had been written by a Stasi psychologist tasked with trying to understand why they were attracting so many willing informants. His conclusion, it was an impulse to make sure your neighbour was doing the right thing. In October 2014, I took a final drive up to visit Lindsay Stone. 4 months had passed since I'd last spoken to her or Farouk. I hadn't called them and they hadn't called me, and given that they'd only taken her on for my benefit, I'd half wondered if maybe it had all been quietly wound down in my absence. Oh, God, no, said Lindsay. We sat at her kitchen table. They call me every week, week after week. You didn't know that? No, I said. I thought you guys were talking all the time, she said. Lindsay got out her phone and scrolled through the innumerable emails from Farouk. She read out loud some blogs his team had written in her voice about how it's important when travelling to use the hotel safe. Stay alert, travellers, and how if you're in Spain you should try the tapas. Lindsay got to pre-approve everything, and she'd only told them no twice, she said, to the blog about how much she's looking forward to Lady Gaga's upcoming jazz album. I like Lady Gaga, but I'm not really excited about her jazz album. And to her tribute to Disneyland on the occasion of its 50th birthday. Happy birthday, Disneyland, the happiest place on earth. Happy birthday, Disneyland, Lindsay blushed. I would never, I mean, I had a great time at Disneyland. Who doesn't? I said. But still, Lindsay trailed off. After we both laughed about the Happy Birthday Disneyland blog, we both stopped laughing and felt bad. They're working so hard, Lindsay said. That is what they have to do, I said. Yeah, Lindsay said. One of my friends from high school said, I hope it's still you. I want people to know how funny you are. But it's scary. After all that's happened, what's funny to me? I don't want to go anywhere near that line, let alone cross it. So I'm constantly saying, I don't know, Farouk, what do you think? This journey started with my identity being hijacked by a spam bot, I said. Your personality has been taken by strangers twice now, but at least this second time around, it's nice. Lindsay hadn't typed her name into Google for 11 months. The last time had been a shock. It was Veterans Day, and she discovered some ex-army people wondering where I was and not in a good way. They were thinking about tracking you down so they could re-destroy you, I asked. Yeah, she said. She hadn't looked since, and now she swallowed and began to type L-I-N. Lindsay shook her head, stunned. This is monumental, she said. 2 years ago, the photograph stretched to Google Images' horizon, uninterrupted, mass production shaming. Pages and pages and pages, Lindsay said, repeating endlessly. It felt so huge, so oppressive. And now, gone. Well, nearly gone. There was still a scattering of them, maybe three or four, but they were interspersed with lots of photographs of Lindsay doing nothing bad, just smiling. Even better, there were lots of photographs of other Lindsay Stones, people who weren't her at all. There was a Lindsay Stone volleyball player, a Lindsay Stone competitive swimmer. The swimmer had been captured mid-stroke, moments from winning the New York State 500-yard freestyle championship. It was captioned, "Lindsay Stone had the right plan in place and everything was going exactly to plan." A whole other person doing something everyone could agree was lovely and commendable. There was no better result than that. Chapter 15. Your Speed. We have always had some influence over the justice system, but for the first time in 180 years, since the stocks and the pillory were outlawed, we have the power to determine the severity of some punishments, and so we have to think about what level of mercilessness we feel comfortable with. I, personally, no longer take part in the ecstatic public condemnation of anybody, unless they've committed a transgression that has an actual victim, and even then, not as much as I probably should. I miss the fun a little, but it feels like I did when I became a vegetarian. I missed the steak, although not as much as I'd anticipated, but I could no longer ignore the slaughterhouse. I kept remembering something Michael Furtick had said to me at the village pub in Woodside. "The biggest lie," he said, "is the internet is about you." We like to think of ourselves as people who have choice and taste and personalised content, but the internet isn't about us. It's about the companies that dominate the data flows of the internet. Now I suddenly wondered, did Google make money from the destruction of Justine Sacco? Could a figure be calculated? And so I joined forces with a number-crunching researcher, Solveig Krause, and began writing to economists and analysts and online ad revenue people. Some things were known. In December 2013, the month of Justine's annihilation, 12.2 billion Google searches took place, a figure that made me feel less worried about the possibility that people were sitting inside Google headquarters personally judging me. Google's ad revenue for that month was $4.69 billion, which meant they made an average of 38 cents for every search query. Every time we typed anything into Google, 38 cents to Google. Of those 12.2 billion searches that December, 1.2 million were people searching the name Justine Sacco. And so, if you average it out, Justine's catastrophe instantaneously made Google $456,000. But it wouldn't be accurate simply to multiply 1.2 million by 38 cents. Some searches are worth more to Google than others. Advertisers bid on high-yield search terms like Coldplay and jewellery and Kenya vacations. It's quite possible that no advertiser ever linked their product to Justine's name, but that wouldn't mean Google made no money from her. Justine was the worldwide number one trending topic on Twitter. Her story engrossed social media users more than any other that night. I think people who wouldn't otherwise have gone on Google did so specifically to hunt for her. She drew people in, and once they were there, I'm sure at least a few of them decided to book a Kenya vacation or download a Coldplay album. I got an email from the economics researcher, Jonathan Hirsch. He'd come recommended by the people who made Freakonomics Radio on WNYC. Jonathan's email said the same thing. Something about this story resonated with them, so much so that they felt compelled to Google her name. That means they're engaged. If interest in Justine was sufficient to encourage users to stay online for more time than they would otherwise, this would have directly resulted in Google making more advertising revenue. Google has the informal corporate motto of "don't be evil," but they make money when anything happens online, even the bad stuff. In the absence of any better data from Google, he wrote, he could only ever offer a back-of-the-envelope calculation. But he thought it would be appropriately conservative, maybe a little too conservative, to estimate Justine's worth being a low-value query at a quarter of the average, which, if true, meant Google made $120,000 from the destruction of Justine Sacco. Maybe that's an accurate figure. Maybe Google made more, or possibly less. But one thing's certain. Those of us who did the actual annihilating, we got nothing. We were unpaid shaming interns for Google. From the beginning, I've been trying to understand why, once you discount Gustave Le Bon and Philip Zimbardo's theories of viruses and contagion and evil, online shaming is so pitiless. And now I think I have the answer. I found it in, of all places, an article about a radical traffic calming scheme tested in California in the early 2000s. The story, by the journalist Thomas Goetz, is a fantastically esoteric one. Goetz writes about how in the school zones of Garden Grove, California, cars were ignoring speed signs and hitting bicyclists and pedestrians with depressing regularity. And so they tried something experimental. They tried your speed signs. As Thomas Goetz wrote, the signs were curious. They didn't tell drivers anything they didn't already know. There is, after all, a speedometer in every car. If a motorist wanted to know their speed, a glance at the dashboard would do it. And the your speed signs came with no punitive follow-up, no police officer standing by, ready to write a ticket. This defied decades of law enforcement dogma, which held that most people obey the speed limits only if they face some clear negative consequence for exceeding them. In other words, officials in Garden Grove were betting that giving speeders redundant information with no consequence would somehow compel them to do something few of us are inclined to do, slow down. But people did slow down. In test after test, the results came back the same. People slowed down by an average of 14%, and they stayed slowed down for miles down the road. Why? During the past decade, the mystery has galvanized social psychologists, and their conclusion, feedback loops. Feedback loops. You exhibit some type of behavior. You drive at 27 miles an hour in a 25 mile an hour zone. You get instant, real-time feedback for it. The sign tells you you're driving at 27 miles an hour. You change your behavior as a result of the feedback. You lower your speed to 25 miles an hour. You get instant feedback for that decision too. The sign tells you you're driving at 25 miles an hour now. Some signs flash up a smiley face emoticon to congratulate you. And it all happens in a flash of an eye, in the few moments it takes you to drive past the your speed sign. In Goetz's Wired magazine story, Harnessing the Power of Feedback Loops, he calls them a profoundly effective tool for changing behaviour. And I'm all for people slowing down in school zones. But maybe in other ways, feedback loops are leading to a world we only think we want. Maybe, as my friend, the documentary maker Adam Curtis, emailed me, they're turning social media into a giant echo chamber where what we believe is constantly reinforced by people who believe the same thing. We express our opinion that Justine Sacco is a monster. We are instantly congratulated for this, for basically being Rosa Parks. We make the on-the-spot decision to carry on believing it. The tech utopians, like the people in Wired, present this as a new kind of democracy, Adam's email continued. It isn't. It's the opposite. It locks people off in the world they started with and prevents them from finding out anything different. They get trapped in the system of feedback reinforcement. Twitter passes lots of information around, but it tends to be the kind of information that people know the others in their particular network will like. So what you get is a kind of mutual grooming. One person sends on information that they know others will respond to in accepted ways, and then, in return, those others will like the person who gave them that piece of information. So information becomes a currency through which you buy friends and become accepted into the system. That makes it very difficult for bits of information that challenge the accepted views to get in. They tend to get squeezed out. When someone says or does something that disturbs the agreed protocols of the system, the other parts react furiously and try to eject that destabilizing fragment and regain stability. And so the idea that there is another world of other people who have other ideas is marginalized in our lives. I was becoming one of those other people with other ideas. I was expressing the unpopular belief that Justine Sacco isn't a monster. I wonder if I will receive a tidal wave of negative feedback for this, and, if so, will it frighten me back again to a place where I'm congratulated and welcomed? Soon after Justine Sacco's shaming, I was talking with a friend, a journalist, who told me he has so many jokes, little observations, potentially risque thoughts that he wouldn't dare to post online anymore. I suddenly feel with social media like I'm tiptoeing around an unpredictable, angry, unbalanced parent who might strike out at any moment, he said. It's horrible. He didn't want me to name him, he said, in case it sparked something off. We see ourselves as nonconformist, but I think all of this is creating a more conformist, conservative age. Look, we're saying, we're normal. This is the average. We are defining the boundaries of normality by tearing apart the people outside of it. Afterword. So You've Been Publicly Shamed was published in hardback in March 2015. A few months earlier, my American publisher sent me a box of Christmas cookies with a card that read, "Get some rest. 2015 is going to be a bumpy year." I emailed him to ask what he meant. He replied that some people were going to hate the book. Oh, nobody's going to hate it, I thought. How could they? I'm right. In January, the New York Times magazine offered to publish an extract concentrating on Justine Sacco's story. 14 months had passed since Justine had pressed send on the AIDS tweet, and she remained absent from social media. Justine and I had kept in contact. She was growing worried. She'd only just got her life back together. After a year in the wilderness, she had a new job in PR, and now it was all going to get stirred up again. "I wish I'd had a little more perspective at the time I agreed to do an interview," she emailed. "Just to know that any press on me will have real repercussions and implications to whatever normalcy I've achieved, and I don't need to prove anything to anyone. I don't need to prove anything to anyone." This struck me as quite a profound reversal, given how Twitter is all about everybody proving things to each other. It's what sparked the disaster. Justine wandering around Heathrow, killing time before her flight, hoping to be congratulated by her 170 Twitter followers for being funny. And it's why everything spiraled while she slept. Thousands of people felt compelled to demonstrate to themselves and each other that they cared about people dying of AIDS in Africa. It was the desire to be compassionate that led so many people to commit the profoundly uncompassionate act of tearing apart a woman as she slept on a plane, unable to explain her joke. The New York Times extract appeared on the morning of February 12th. Justine emailed me a few hours later. "I've received a ton of feedback, people who I don't know, reaching out to show their support and commend me for handling that debacle with grace. Thanks, John. I'm very glad you told my story." I mention this not for self-aggrandizing reasons, but because of the realization it gave me that the cure for shame is empathy. But she did have one objection. The Times website had headlined the extract, "How one tweet destroyed Justine Sacco's life." "My life is not ruined," she wrote. "My resilience makes me who I am. The world can try to break a person, but only that person can allow herself to be broken. I took major steps to overcome that debacle. I stayed true to myself, and that got me through the darkest time in my life. I don't want people to think I'm at the bottom of a depression pit, because I'm truly not." The Times agreed to change the headline to "How One Tweet Blew Up Justine Sacco's Life." Like Justine, I received a lot of emails the day the extract was published. All of them were positive. People telling me that they'd sent the story to their children as a warning against them tweeting something that might be misconstrued. I understood why parents would want to do that, but it wasn't the message I was going for. If anyone should change their behaviour, I thought, it ought to be those doing the shaming. Justine's crime had been a badly worded joke mocking privilege. To see the catastrophe as her fault felt to me a little like, don't wear short skirts. It felt like victim blaming. "The essay might be a turning point," wrote Peter Bradshaw in The Guardian. "Twitter shaming allows people who complacently think of themselves as basically nice to indulge in the dark thrill of bullying in a righteous cause. Perhaps Ronson's article will cause a questioning of Twitter's instant Salem culture of shame." People were realising, as Megan O'Giblin put it in the Boston Review, that what happened to Justine wasn't social justice. It was a cathartic alternative. "Twitter's outrage machine should be stopped, but Justine Sacco is the wrong poster child. Why Sacco and why now? Why are we making this person our go-to cautionary tale of how social media can derail careers, a case study in unjust persecution, and an inspiring narrative of image rehabilitation and forgiveness? There are far more vulnerable people who have been left to fend for themselves against cyber mobs and internet trolls. Certainly there was palpable misogyny to some of the abuse Sacco endured during her brief period in the spotlight, but other women have had it far worse. Feminist writers and activists like Jessica Valenti struggle to keep up public writing in the face of constant online attacks. The vulnerability of women of colour is even more intense. Prominent scholars like Anthea Butler of the University of Pennsylvania face onslaughts of racist harassment just for speaking their mind. Justine Sacco is a sympathetic figure because she's a 30-something, well-educated, relatively affluent, white woman, on a level that resonates with some of the ugliest of America's racist narratives. The blonde Sacco is archetypally vulnerable, the damsel to be rescued from a rampaging mob. Patrick Blanchfield, Washington Post, 24th of February 2015. The thing is, I wrote about Justine not because I identified with her, although I did, but because I identified with the people who tore her apart. I consider myself a social justice person. It was my people abusing our power, and that felt more mysterious to me than when some racist or misogynist troll goes after someone. Also, I was interested in mass shamings. Shamings that unite vast, disparate groups. Decent, smart people recognise who the villain is when a misogynist attacks a feminist writer. But it was decent, smart people who tore Justine apart. Justine was cast as the villain across social media, and then the mainstream media, and she had no support network. The flame was burning too hot. The journalist Helen Lewis, reviewing my book in The New Statesman, wrote that she was on Twitter that night. Tentatively, at the time, I tried to suggest that perhaps the tweet wasn't that bad. Certainly not bad enough to warrant the rape and death threats that were flooding in. Fellow tweeters began to argue that I was being a typical white middle-class feminist, sticking up for a powerful PR executive and ignoring the voices of wronged people of colour. So I did something I have been ashamed of ever since. I shut up and looked on as Justine Sacco's life got torn apart. Helen Lewis, New Statesman, 11th of March 2015. Condemnation of my story began hesitantly at first, a little uncertain, like a consensus waiting to form. The article did nothing but bring her back into the spotlight when we'd all moved on, someone tweeted. Her dad is a billionaire, someone replied. I'm not too worried about her. Justine's father isn't a billionaire. He sells carpets. That tweet didn't ruin her life, someone added. Justine Sacco has a new job. Give me a break already. After a year, I thought, when I read that one. She finally got a full-time job after a year. Nice people like us had effectively sentenced Justine to a year's punishment for the crime of some poor phraseology in a tweet, as if some clunky wording had been a clue to her secret inner evil. The fact that Justine had doggedly managed to pull things back together after a year was now being used as evidence that the shaming had been no big deal from the start. I remembered a time I was on a beach in Scotland and a flock of terns singled me out. They circled above me for a while and then began to dive bomb, pecking at my head. I ran back to the road, shrieking and waving my arms in the air. You're probably too close to their eggs, my wife Elaine shouted after me. You should be aware of their nests. I have no idea where their nests are, I yelled back. This early tentative disapproval felt like the terns circling, and then the dive bombing began. After reading that excerpt from his book, I think it's safe to say John Ronson is a fucking racist. A group of Chelsea football fans were filmed on the Paris Metro, pushing a black man off the train and chanting, we're racist, and that's the way we like it. It was a shocking, awful video. Maybe John Ronson will cape up for them, someone wrote. I emailed Justine. I'm getting an idea of what it was like to be you. I'm really sorry if you're getting death threats, she emailed back. No one should receive threats or words of violence at all. Well, nobody's threatening to actually kill me, I replied. As is often the case, the range of insults levelled against Justine, a woman, had been far broader than those levelled against me, a man. Most people were enjoying the book, but among a group who hadn't read it, an opinion was beginning to form and feed off itself that it was an attack on social justice, a defence of white privilege. In coming out against online shaming, I was silencing marginalised voices, because online shaming is the only recourse of the marginalised, whereas the world automatically allows people like Justine to succeed. But I just couldn't see how Justine's shaming made anything better, given that her joke was intended to mock racism. What happened to Justine struck me as just another terrible thing happening in the world. I couldn't tell how many people were forming this opinion about the book. It felt unnerving. I decided to say nothing, although there were things I wanted to say. I wanted to say that for years I've been writing stories about abuses of power, when the people abusing their power were over there, in the military or the pharmaceutical industry. Everyone loved it. When I wrote about labelling out of control in the mental health world, about four-year-old American children getting categorised as bipolar because of their temper tantrums, everybody agreed that that was bad. But as soon as I wrote that we were the ones abusing our power, categorising others on the scantest evidence, people were saying that I must be a racist too. I decided to try and encourage those people to read the book, and so I tweeted, by the way, the Justine Sacco story in the New York Times isn't a standalone article, it's an extract from a book. Oh, now Ronson's saying it's an extract from a book, someone wrote. What did that mean? It was always an extract from a book. Did you think I ran home and quickly wrote a book? But anything I said in that moment, I realised, would just be more evidence for the prosecution, and so I went back to being silent. Why isn't John Ronson replying to any of us? Someone tweeted. Because John Ronson only replies to men, someone replied. I liked it when people went for me in ridiculous ways, because when I recounted those comments to other people, they made me look good. I didn't regret writing Justine's story. I was basically being told, it's fine to write about those wronged people, but don't write about that wronged person because it makes us look bad. But a wronged person is a wronged person, even when they're an unfashionable wronged person. A train crashed in Philadelphia. It was a derailment at 102 miles an hour. Passenger cars were ripped apart. 8 people died and 200 more were hospitalised, some with critical injuries. Everywhere you looked, you could see pieces of the train all around you, one witness told CNN. You could see people trying to crawl out. There were 2 people above our heads in the luggage rack asking to be helped down, another said. I saw so many head injuries and bloody faces, said a third. There were a lot of fractures, arms, shoulders, all kinds of fractures. A survivor emerged from the wreckage and tweeted, thanks a lot for derailing my train. Can I please get my violin back from the second car of the train? In the early days, Twitter was a place of curiosity and empathy. Back then, people might have responded to this woman, are you okay? Or, what was it like? But that's not how Twitter and Facebook responded now. Instead, Twitter and Facebook responded, some spoilt asshole is whining about her violin being on that Amtrak that derailed. People died on that train. And, unfortunately, too many people think only of themselves and not of their fellow man. And, she's an idiot. I hope the violin is crushed. And I hope someone picks it up and smacks it against the train. And fuck that little bitch and her goddamn violin. I would slap the fucking taste out of her mouth if she was in reach. You're a little asshole. And then, after she deleted her Twitter account, too bad she's a coward and deleted her account. How will her violin ever be returned? And I hope you get your violin back from under the bleeding people. Good luck. And I hope it is destroyed. And your violin can be replaced. The dead are gone forever. And self-absorbed cunt. And I won't be cutting her any slack. What a sickening skank. I hope her life is exactly what a nasty bitch deserves. And 8 passengers dead, but she lives. No justice in the world. And entitlement at its finest. Like Justine, she was being shamed because she was perceived to have misused her privilege. And of course, the misuse of privilege is a much better thing to get people for than the things we used to get people for, like having children out of wedlock. But a great number of people who hadn't just been in a train crash were now accusing a woman who had just been in a train crash of being privileged. The phrase misuse of privilege was becoming a free pass to tear apart pretty much anybody we chose to. It was becoming a devalued term, and was making us lose our capacity for empathy and for distinguishing between serious and unserious transgressions. I visited a TV studio in New York to film a video about the book. There was a doctor on before me, filming her own video. "What's your book about?" she asked me. "Online shaming," I replied. "Oh, did you read that piece in the New York Times?" she asked. "I wrote it," I replied. "Oh, you must be so happy," she said. "Actually, I'm not," I replied. "Why not?" she said. "Because there's a backlash with people calling me a racist," I said. "So what do you want?" she said. "Xanax," I said. She got out her pad and wrote me a prescription for 60 Xanax. I'm just going to make a slight digression here for listeners of the audiobook, that when I got home that day and told my family what had happened, that I'd met this doctor, and she asked me what I wanted, and I said Xanax. My son said, "You should have asked for OxyContin." So anyway, she got out her pad and wrote me a prescription for 60 Xanax. After that, I was no longer anxious, but I felt groggy. I had to weigh up whether to feel groggy or anxious. Later, I mentioned this to the comedian Joe Rogan. "Welcome to America," he replied. "That's our dilemma, groggy or anxious." Peter Bradshaw's Guardian column turned out to be extremely wrong. My story about Justine wasn't a turning point. Twitter shamings didn't abate. They gathered pace crazily. Some of the shamed were, like Justine and the violin woman, easy to sympathise with. They just made some stupid misstep, like the scientist Matt Taylor, who flew a probe 310 million miles, landed it on the surface of a comet, but wore an inappropriate shirt while doing so. The shirt, designed by a female friend, was covered with drawings of Barbarella-type women in lingerie. The vitriol he received on social media as a result was so biting. No, no, women are totally welcome in our community. Just ask the dude in this shirt, and so on. He burst into tears at the press conference the next day. The tweeters were right, of course, about the massive gender imbalance in science, but still, he had just landed a probe on a comet, the first time this feat had been accomplished in human history, and now he was crying on television. Was I feeling so sorry for him because his distress was visible, right before my eyes, while the distress of the women who can't get a break in science is subtler, more systemic and less schmaltzy? Or was I feeling sorry for him because he was an individual, a schmucky guy taking the heat for a massive issue way beyond his sphere of influence? Maybe it was a bit of both. For some people, his tearful apology wasn't enough. I personally hope that one day, when he's a little less busy, Taylor will say a bit more on the subject and show that he understands why the shirt wasn't okay, blogged a science writer in the Washington Post. Other people were much more deserving of a shaming, like the Minnesota dentist Walter Palmer, whose hunting party lured a much-loved lion, Cecil, from his protective preserve at Hwange National Park in Zimbabwe, shot him with a bow and arrow and then trapped him for 40 hours before shooting, skinning and beheading him. The details were so repulsive they galvanised social media like never before. Three people I knew felt so sickened they posted his home address and telephone number on their Facebook pages. One of them telephoned him at home in the middle of the night to scream at him. He wasn't in. The next day they all reported feeling shocked by how ferociously they'd thrown themselves into this new hunt. Mia Farrow, who I talk to sometimes on Twitter, had also posted his home address to her 654,000 Twitter followers. Later she tweeted me, "I got a little carried away myself." Other people posted Mia Farrow's home address in retaliation, and so on. Shamings are always about more than the transgression. I'm sure Walter Palmer's shaming scared other Westerners out of booking big-game hunting vacations, and that felt like a victory, although a somewhat disingenuous one given that 100,000 elephants were killed by poachers between 2011 and 2014, and social media didn't go after those people because they weren't perceived to have misused their privilege. I am not, by the way, an expert on poaching. I only know this because I read it on a website. But his shaming was disconcertingly barbarous, disconcerting even to some of the people who'd been barbarous. Plus, of course, he had employees, a family, a lot of collateral damage. It reminded me of the shaming of an ESPN reporter, Britt McHenry, who'd been caught on CCTV coldly mauling a garage attendant after her car had been towed away. "I'm on television and you're in a fucking trailer, honey," she told the woman. "Makes my skin crawl even being here. So I could be a college dropout and do the same thing? Lose some weight, baby girl." And so on. Twitter responded with, "Wow, the more I watch that Britt McHenry tape, the more I'd like to punch her in the fucking face. Enuno acts like that. Hashtag cunt." And, "Get some class. Hashtag Britt McHenry. Hashtag cunt." And, "You classless cunt." And, "End your life." And so on. Shaming was becoming the reflex response to practically any behaviour that people didn't like. So I suppose it was inevitable I would eventually get my own. It had all started back in 2014 with Mercedes Hafer, the woman from 4chan. I'd asked her why the language was so much more violent when levelled against shamed women than it was for men. When men get shamed, it's, I'm going to get you fired. When women get shamed, it's, I'm going to rape you. Yeah, it is a bit extreme, Mercedes replied. 4chan takes the worst thing it can imagine that person going through and shouts for it to happen. 4chan aims to degrade the target, right? And one of the highest degradations for women in our culture is rape. We don't talk about rape of men, so I think it doesn't occur to most people as a male degradation. With men, they talk about getting them fired. In our society, men are supposed to be employed. If they're fired, they lose masculinity points. With Donglegate, she pointlessly robbed that man of his employment. She degraded his masculinity, and so the community responded by degrading her femininity. I thought a lot about what Mercedes said during the days that followed. As it happens, my anxiety manifests itself in two ways. One, if I can't get my family on the phone, I assume they're dead. In the old days, when my son was a toddler, I'd be convinced my wife had fallen down the stairs, had broken her neck, and my son, at the exact moment the phone was ringing out, was reaching up to grab a just-boiled kettle. One night at a hotel in Washington, D.C., in the days before cell phones, I panicked so much, telephoning neighbours and the police and the fire brigade. The phone bill for one night came to $900. Eventually, I went to see the hypnotist, Paul McKenna, who cured me. But he only cured the part about my wife. Nowadays, if I can't get my wife on the phone, I'm fine. Whereas my son, he's 17 now. I subscribe to the Twitter feed of every New York City emergency service, so if I wake up and he isn't there and he doesn't pick up the phone, I can at least check whether someone matching his description has been killed. As a result, I am aware of every bad thing unfolding in New York City. Every shooting, every stabbing, every person trapped under a piece of collapsed construction equipment, which happens more often than you'd think. That crane you're walking under as you're listening to this audiobook, it might fall on you. 2. Work. Have I misquoted someone? Have I got a fact wrong? Have I not made myself clear? I once asked Randy Newman why he writes songs. He replied, "It's how I judge myself and how I feel better." That's exactly how I feel about my own writing. And it's practical, too. If I couldn't work, how would I feed my family? What would happen to us? And so on. Those are the thoughts that stab at my brain when I wake up in the middle of the night. But when Mercedes said that to me, I understood that I was lucky. I only have those two. My anxious brain doesn't go to the fear of being raped. I have never feared being raped. I'm sure, in part, because I'm a man. And so I wrote a few lines for straight under Mercedes' quote. I'd never thought of it that way before, that men feel about getting fired the same way women feel about getting raped. I don't know if Mercedes was right, but I do know this. I can't think of many worse things than being fired. I was happy with the line. In a few words, I thought, I'd managed to convey some complicated ideas about plausible fears. I was acknowledging my own privilege. I don't carry around the terrible anxiety that I may one day be raped. But the book was full of people who had been fired because social media blithely demanded it. It was good to remind people that it is a big deal. It's not rape, but it's not nothing. In August 2014, 6 months before this book was published, uncorrected proofs were sent out into the book world. These are early versions of books offered to book industry professionals. Maybe they'll persuade a bookseller to set aside space in some future window display. Maybe you'll get included in some books to watch out for in 2015 list. Printed on the front are the words, "Not for quotation." There's a good reason for that. Authors often decide to make last-minute changes. I frequently do, all the way down to the wire. In November 14, my British editor passed me an email. While reading John Ronson's new book that you sent over last week, I came across a section and a particular paragraph that truly shocked me. I'd never thought about it that way before, that men feel about getting fired the same way women feel about getting raped. I don't know if Mercedes was right, but I do know this. I can't think of many worse things than being fired. I know it is an uncorrected book proof. However, that is an insane idea to even postulate. I'm pretty sure men and women feel the same way about getting raped. A violent, soul life-destroying act can't quite be compared to losing your job. Losing your job is awful, particularly if you have a family to provide for, but it is not rape. I reread the email. Nobody could possibly think I'm suggesting that being fired is as bad as being raped, I thought. But somebody was thinking it. I don't want to upset readers. So I showed the email to my friend, Starley Kine. Cut the line, she said. People could misconstrue it. Nobody's going to misconstrue it, I said. Cut the line, she said. I cut the line. It never made it into the book. In March, I embarked on a 2-month book tour. On stage in London, I compared Twitter to the Stasi, and someone in the audience loudly tutted. I can understand why he tutted. It sounded overblown, but I remain convinced that the real reason why he tutted was because he hadn't thought it through. According to Anna Funder's research, the Stasi was populated by many willing volunteers fueled by a desire to ensure their neighbours were doing the right thing. Later in the signing queue, a woman told me that she was a child psychiatrist, and almost every child she sees nowadays is damaged by something that happened on social media. The Q&A in Norwich was unexpectedly tense. The first question was, "As a Jew, you should be thinking long and hard about Netanyahu." Given that I hadn't said anything about Netanyahu during the talk, the question came from left field. Plus, it was more of a statement than a question. Plus, Netanyahu has literally nothing to do with me. The second question, in response to my recounting of the Justine Sacco story, was, "Are you a racist?" In Santa Cruz, an elderly woman in the front row robustly shook her head in disagreement, practically non-stop for the duration of my talk. When she caught my eye, her head shaking intensified. During the Q&A, she said, "Well, if someone wants to play with the Twitter toy, it's their fault if they get burned." But this wasn't a story about Twitter. It was a story about us. It was also a story about Twitter, about how this flawed information-swapping service was setting the agenda now, as if the mainstream media, already insecure about its place in the new world, was allowing social media to tell it what to think, before dutifully stepping into line. Social media was a toy as much as the printing press had been a toy. Also, Justine had 170 Twitter followers. Nobody ever responded to her tweets. She had been a comedian telling jokes in an empty room. Justine could never have foreseen what would happen to her as she fell asleep on that plane. It was unprecedented. There were good times too. In Toronto, I appeared on Canada's version of Loose Women, or The View. I told the Justine Sacco story. When I read out her AIDS tweets, the audience gasped in shock and outrage. "It's okay," I explained. "She wasn't intending to be racist." "Ah," the audience replied happily. "Wow," I thought. "People are so pliable. I should be a cult leader." Before my talk in Minneapolis, I went into the local public radio station for an interview down the line to Madison, Wisconsin. I had a few seconds to spare before going live, and so I quickly checked Twitter, and that was when I saw it. For listeners of this audiobook, I should explain the picture that's now printed in the book. It's the line from the uncorrected proof of my book. I'd never thought about it that way before, that men feel about getting fired the same way women feel about getting raped. I don't know if Mercedes was right, but I do know this. I can't think of many worse things than being fired. And the tweeter had tweeted, after linking to that picture, "Oh, hey, nope." The tweeter was a New York City freelance journalist. "You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is John Ronson." The comments under the tweet read, "Oh my God, what the shit? What? Who is this garbage? John Ronson's new book, Screaming, What the fuck? What the fuck? What the actual fuck? The logical leap he took between graphs. I'm literally lolling. You can hear him whispering, should I do it? It's almost like he's trying to get us to publicly shame him. What if this is his public shaming? I hate men. They always fail us. OMG, and people are talking about this book as great.